Hi folks, I'm Kevin Lauderdale, one of the usual suspects on Temple of Bad. As you're about to hear, I ended up doing the recording and editing on this one episode instead of Dan, and it didn't turn out so hot. I was using a jury-rigged system, and my dog was running around, etc. I edited out what I could, and we applied some filters, but this just isn't up to our usual level of quality. Sorry about that. The content is top-notch. And the good news is Dan and his machines will be back next time. So why not make a drinking game out of it? Take a drink every time you hear my dog bark. Take a drink every time you hear his collar jingle. Take a drink every time you hear my kids come in and slam the door. Who knew you could hear the back door slam all the way down here in the basement? Anyway, on with the show.
Hey, Kevin, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, Hawk, are you there?
I'm here, too.
Hey, Dan, are you there? No, that's right. Dan's not here this time around, because he's on a hiatus, which we hope will be mercifully brief. Since he couldn't make it today, we're going to be doing things a little differently in this episode. I'm going to be playing the part of substitute host for this episode, and Kevin is going to be doing the recording and editing. And finally, joining Kevin and me and filling in the third side of our conversational triangle is our special guest, podcaster extraordinaire and B-movie aficionado, Arenthal Hawkins. Woohoo!
I got nothing.
He's saving it all for the discussion. That's what he meant. That's what he really meant. Okay, guys. So to start off this episode, I have a few quick questions. You ready?
Okay.
Okay.
Do black and white movies make you happy?
Yes.
That depends.
Do cheap black and white movies that use lots of stock footage make you happy?
Depends on the stock footage.
Yes, that incoherent mumbling is my answer.
Do you enjoy the haunting sound of the theremin?
There are no bad theremin players in this world.
Are there any good theremin players in this world?
Okay, and finally, do films starring John Carradine and John Agar make you giggle like a schoolgirl?
Schoolgirl?
Okay.
They make me giggle.
All right, maybe that last one was just me. Well, we are going to be talking about the 1959 film Invisible Invaders, starring John Carradine and John Agar, on this episode of Mighty Movies, Temple of Bad. Welcome to Mighty Movies, Temple of Bad, the place where we celebrate films that are so awful, it's practically a religious experience. I'm Andrea Lipinski.
I'm Kevin Lauderdale.
And I'm Arenthal Hawkins.
And on this episode of Temple of Bad, we're going to be discussing Invisible Invaders, which was my film choice this time around. Invisible Invaders, like each of the movies we've selected so far in this podcast, is currently available to watch on Netflix Instant. It's also available on Amazon Instant Video for under $5. So you have several options available if you'd like to enjoy or suffer along with us. So let me start by telling you why I picked this movie. I love bad movies that make me laugh, and this one is pretty ridiculous. I am especially a fan of old-fashioned black and white movies that take themselves very seriously, with the narrator and actors saying these stupidest lines in a very serious manner. And plus, I love John Carradine and I love John Agar. Woo!
I just thought you were a nut job.
Also possible. Anyway, the plot of the film, such as it is that Dr. Carol Neumann, also known as John Carradine, is very quickly killed in a lab explosion. And then an invisible alien possesses his dead body and tries to convince peace-loving scientist Adam Penner that the aliens are going to take over the Earth and that Dr. Penner should convince the Earthlings to surrender. Penner tries, but the people of Earth don't listen until it's too late. And then there's a big chunk of the movie in which Dr. Penner, his beautiful daughter, another scientist who's kind of a wuss, and a military man, Air Force Major Bruce J., played by John Agar, are holed up in a laboratory slash bunker trying to figure out how to defeat the invisible aliens that are reanimating dead Earthlings all over the place. And in between, there's a lot of stock footage, a lot of theremin music, and a lot of science stuff. So right around this point is where we usually play the trailer for the movie we're going to discuss, but when I looked online for a trailer for Invisible Invader, I couldn't find one. Now, I've heard that it exists and that it's available on the Midnight Movies DVD version, but that doesn't help us right now. So, sorry, no trailer. This time, you will just have to settle for word pictures instead. So, let's discuss. Hey, come on, we can come up with some word pictures.
No, I just, because this movie is pretty much all about imagination.
Yes.
Yet describing it requires even more imagination than that, I'm not sure that we can do this movie justice.
How much imagination are we going to need to discuss this movie?
Well, a lot of the characters are invisible, so there's a problem.
Hey, they're only mostly invisible. They're only invisible for most of the time. Well, but one of the things that I wanted to address, okay, the first thing that I wanted to address. So, Kevin, let's look at how a hell of a plot in which a lot of stuff happens was crammed into just 1 hour and 6 minutes.
So it seemed like a lot longer.
No, it seemed like a lot longer to me because it took me... Are you ready? Are you sitting down?
Okay.
It took me 2 days to watch the first 23 minutes because I kept having to stop the film because I was laughing and I wanted to write down what they said because it was so doofy. But anyway, what did you think of the pacing of this movie and how they got so much stuff to happen in such a short time?
By cutting the stock footage all the time, it gave us a real sense of action and urgency because there was no action and urgency when the actual actors were on screen.
Aw.
No!
It's about like a Eugene O'Neill play, really. There's just one or two sets and people stand around talking.
How dare you. I love Eugene O'Neill plays. Wait, maybe that's why I like this movie.
They did it through smoke and mirrors and through the very clever use of narration to tell you what's going on, in case you weren't sure.
And newspaper headlines.
Spinning newspapers, yay! Hey, that was in Citizen Kane, so we can allow that.
Have we just compared this movie already to a Eugene O'Neill play and to Citizen Kane?
I can't even believe that happened. Is that even possible?
Yeah, we can also compare it to a Bugs Bunny cartoon because of my favorite special effect in this movie, small piles of dirt moving around the ground.
Oh, yes.
So, Hawk, well, what do you think?
I just have to say,
yes.
When I saw this movie was 1 hour and 6 minutes, I'm thinking, I'm going to breeze through this thing. No problem. And I had to stop a few times, not because I was laughing, but to literally do the oh my god face. And I'm furiously writing notes. I can't believe they did. I can't believe. Really? 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 And I got nothing. I mean, really, there is so much happening, yet nothing happens. You know what it reminds me of in that respect? M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening.
Oh,
a
no.
A movie so badly titled because in that movie, nothing happens.
Ouch.
In this movie, in the end, nothing happens. Oh, yes, there is, you know, some stock footage of some stuff happening.
Aww.
But really, with the actors themselves, very little occurs.
Yeah, but look, there's so much stuff that happens so quickly. I mean, let's not forget John Carradine's first appearance in this picture.
Should we tell them what happens? How the movie opens with the greatest explosion of all time?
What explosion? That's some dust thrown up in the air.
Well, it was stock footage of an explosion. That counts.
How long? Is it 30 seconds in? John Carradine is mixing atomic materials with his bare hands and two beakers, I guess. Is that how they do it over at Slack and the Large Hadron thing? I know. When, theoretically, it all explodes and there's a nuclear explosion in his lab.
I mean, his first appearance is literally like 5 seconds long.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they have the spinning newspaper headline that appears with a picture of him explaining that he has died. And my first thought when I saw this was, you have John Carradine in a movie, and in 30 seconds in, he's gone?
What a cameo.
Why is he back? Even in the credits?
You know what? If you see that the video and, you know, the box for the video has his picture on it, you really hope that he's not just in it for 5 seconds. You hope he's going to be appearing somewhere else. And he does sort of appear, but then there are also portions of the picture where he's appearing but not really appearing. You know, he could just do it from home or over the phone. But, I mean, his appearance is so – I mean, that was hilarious, and that was one of the points where I had to stop. Because, yes, he is a noted scientist. But the point is, he's a physicist. Okay. Did people not understand how physics worked? Okay. I know I'm not great at physics. But even I know that a physics lab is not the kind with beakers of liquid around that you just sort of mix together like in any other, you know, 1950s, you know, scientist movie. And he does have the beaker of mysterious liquid in his hand, which he is holding, as Kevin noted, without the use of tongs or even gloves. He looks at the contents of the beaker, he looks at us, and then boom. I mean, it's 5 seconds long. Not since Bela Lugosi's character was run over by a car off screen in Plan 9 from Outer Space was a character killed off so quickly and so cheaply.
But then, they killed off Bela Lugosi because he had actually died.
Well, there's that.
Yeah,
John Carradine was still alive.
Are you sure? He didn't look very good.
Well, when he returns, the most important thing is he's apparently all in one piece. He hasn't been completely atomized. And he's also apparently not radioactive, which you would expect for someone standing at the center of an atomic explosion.
How dare you use logic?
No, that's very interesting, because right towards the end of the movie, you have people running around with Geiger counters all over the place. But yeah, nobody's discussing the fact that, right, radioactivity, right? So he should have been, you know, giving off radioactive waves all that time. But, I mean, there's so much stuff that happens, and I mean, because I was, you know, writing down, like, this happened. And then I'd look at the clock, 4 minutes? Wait, only 4 minutes happened? But all this other stuff happened. Now, Hawk, after you saw this movie, you commented to us about how this movie was so cheap. Your first comment was about how that was 1 hour and 6 minutes of your life that you weren't going to get back. And then you said how cheap it was. But tell us why cheap was the operative word that sprang to mind when you saw this movie.
Well, there are a number of reasons. First of all, the title of the movie is Invisible Invaders. And yes, the invaders are invisible. There's a lot of cheap wire effects to move things around. There's the shuffling footstep effect where you've got these mounds of dirt moving. But there's not a lot of money spent on actual aliens. And when you do see the aliens for brief bits, when they appear, they're really just people wrapped up in bandages. So and filmed fuzzily. So really, you don't need to spend... They didn't spend an enormous amount of money making aliens. The aliens invade. We never see their spaceships or any of their equipment because guess what? Their equipment is invisible too. And then we're treated to enormous amounts of stock footage for almost everything. And a lot of the action isn't moved along by the actors. It's moved along by a narrator speaking in deep narrative tones. If I had $5, I could have made this movie. And this is something I was thinking about as I'm watching it, as part of the cheapness of this movie. There's a point in this movie where the aliens announce their presence and they warn people. The first time they do this is at a hockey game. And we see stock footage of a hockey game. first of all, after my brain wrapped around the cheapness of the stock footage of the hockey game, the next thing my brain did was, why would an alien make an announcement at a sporting event? Not only that, he makes the announcement, he's making the announcement over the air. So I'm assuming it's going to be radio in 1959. Television's still a young medium, even though televisions are starting to grow up, it's still a young medium. But even so, not every household has a TV. Almost every household has a radio, but not every household has a TV. So who precisely is the alien reaching? And if he's saying the stuff over the air, why do the people in the stadium panic? And why would they panic if one person says it's an alien invasion? You know what happens if one person gets up at a hockey game and says there's an alien invasion happening? He gets his ass kicked.
Well, yeah, hockey fans are a rough bunch. I mean, not the polite, well-dressed ones that we saw, but, I mean, hockey fans I know are a rough bunch. And, yeah, I figured they would have turned on the alien. But, right, one person inside an announcer booth does not an invasion make.
It wasn't even a real announcer booth. It's some cheap walls with a door in it so someone could walk through.
If you're going to announce a sporting event, pick a popular sport like baseball or football. Nobody's listening to a hockey game over the radio.
Not in 1959.
No. The other possibility is that it wasn't going out over the radio. That was an announcer for the stadium, in which case even fewer people heard the announcement that the Earth was being taken over. No wonder nobody reacted.
Well, nobody outside reacted. Exactly. Apparently all the people in the stadium were panicked.
Well, that's because they had footage of people in a stadium getting up and running and doing something.
I mean, really? Really? Yeah, that's the operative word with this movie. Really?
Evan, you have any thoughts about how cheap this movie was?
I think Hawk pretty much nailed it. When you start with the premise that your aliens are going to be invisible, you've pretty much explored everything you can possibly explore right there.
Yeah, I mean, it was different. Now, I had a sort of aside question that perhaps you can answer, but maybe this also ties into cheapness too, right? So your aliens are cheap to film if you can't actually see them, and then all that you have to do is sort of, you know, put those tracks. But instead of doing, like, you know, footprints or tracks, which they would usually do, they did this weird thing where the aliens all look like they're shuffling and they can't pick their feet up. So, yeah, it was kind of like Bugs Bunny. It also reminded me, there was a story by Stephen King, which was a pretty good story, which was made into an abysmal movie. And the story was Children of the Corn.
I've heard of it, yep.
I've heard of the movie, never seen
it. So, Children of the Corn, the story, has a character that the other characters refer to, somebody who you never see, but it's very he's very ominously called He Who Walks Behind the Rose, right? So it's somebody who you never see, but you know that he's there right on the other side of the corn stalks. So in the story, they refer to this character as He Who Walks Behind the Rose. Then you watch the movie, and the movie does the Bugs Bunny effect. And you're like, He Who Tunnels Behind the Rose? You're like, was that cheaper? Or was that supposed to be more terrifying? Or was that more ominous? I mean, the fact that whenever you see the aliens walking, all you see are their feet, and which is represented by, and IMDb says that you can see the actual wires that are dragging the dirt. Now, I did not see that myself, but I guess it's entirely possible. You know, I don't know. But see, now here I'm getting into the alien logic of, like, if you're going to walk around like that, number one, people are going to see exactly where you are so they could attack you. And number two, they're going to see your weakness, which is that you have big, heavy feet.
If you want to jump into alien logic, I'm not even sure why exactly they want to do, which is kill people, then take over their bodies. Why do they need to do that? They clearly are already corporeal, and if they've managed to create technology that includes spaceships, they can probably see each other, I'm guessing. Why do they need our bodies?
Because it's scarier?
I have no idea how that was supposed to work. First of all, I was thinking, how do you build invisible spaceships? Well, you know, and do you remember where you parked?
My assumption is they can see each other. They're all on the same visible wavelength thing. Although, as we saw in an early scene, they can make regular matter visible and invisible by doing something to a small ball of aluminum foil.
Yes, speaking of cheap, let me show you a piece of our SpaceX technology that we use to make our spaceships. And he goes, woo, 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 and he highlights the thing, and you look at the thing, and it really looks like a crumpled up piece of tinfoil. You're like, science! Look at this! All right, so Kevin, you had said, when I asked what were some topics that you guys wanted to discuss, you told us that you thought that the characters in this film were smarter than most movie characters who found themselves in similar situations. Tell us what you mean by that, and
back it up.
Prepared to defend your position.
Provide three examples.
Yeah, you better defend yourself on that one. I want mathematical proof of this. You're going to have to write this out like the Regents.
Okay.
Show your work.
Now, first of all, in all fairness, this movie goes from really stupid to smart to stupid to smart, back and forth. I mean, first of all, the idea that the aliens want to kill us and take over our bodies is stupid. But the way in which the aliens do it is quite clever. They don't go down one-on-one taking us out. They let our environment do the destroying for them. They blow up dams. They blow up industrial plants. They do mass murder. It's a long-standing trope in science fiction that if you want to take over the world, just throw a couple meteorites at Earth and then just sit back and relax and let everything else do the destroying for you. The alien actual execution, I thought, was fairly clever, as opposed to just shooting us all with ray guns one by one. Okay. Once our heroes are hunkered down in their base, I think they use relatively applicable logic. Okay. They think the aliens come into dead bodies through the skin. So they say, great, we'll cover the skin with an acrylic, trapping the aliens inside. I think that could work. I think that's a smarter idea than putting them in chains, let's say. I mean, that's actual applying actual science. Okay. Oh, so when they decide to trap one of the aliens in a big pool of acrylic, okay, maybe that's a little silly, they put a rope in first so that something will harden and they'll be able to pull the body out. They're using foresight. They're using actual planning and thinking. I just thought a lot of the science they talked about actually seemed to make sense. They have radiation detectors. They're looking for radiation. They're not just stupid kids in the woods cowering going, what are we going to do? What are we going to do?
Okay, Hawk, would you like to begin the rebuttal process?
Let me start by saying that the aliens were not smart because they're invisible, their equipment is invisible, and they announced their presence. They really want to destroy us. Just come and do it. We wouldn't know.
And do it invisibly.
Yes, 5 minutes, it's over. Done. What? Something? Boom, boom, boom. Bye. So, nice knowing you. By the way, we're aliens. We're here. We're invisible. And you're dead. So, their brilliant plan was to announce that they were coming. If I'm going to invade you, I'm not telling you. I'm not giving you an opportunity to build some sort of defense. You know, and even if my ego is really, really huge, I'm still not announcing, because guess what? Even though I think I'm superior to you, it just makes my life easier. Why would I make the job harder? You know, I mean, if my ego's that big, I'm lazy. So, again, not necessarily that smart a plan. And the science? We're going to trap them with acrylic. How do you know that they can't walk through acrylic? They are possessing bodies. They're already walking through matter. You know, somehow acrylic is going to stop them? Yes. If acrylic's going to stop them, you need to try and figure out other materials that could stop them. You know, did cotton not stop? Did wool not stop them? Did you know? I mean, they're walking through matter. Matter is matter at a certain point. If they can go through A, they could probably go through B. So why would you think the acrylic would trap them?
But to be fair, it did.
Well, yes, because a bunch of writers got in the room and said, how can we trap them? I got it. That was me doing a typewriter, by the way. Because they weren't using computers back then. Oh, good Lord. So, they're not that bright. And the whole thing, another point of stupid. The military gentleman, played by John Agar, is confronted by a civilian in the road holding a shotgun. And it takes him a while to shoot him. Now, everything's going to hell. These people are very important. They got to get them to the bunker. And he's negotiating with this guy. No, that's not what happens. Gun comes, bang. Someone goes down. So, not really thinking this out, boy. So,
I have another major piece here that fits into the man, you are a doofus puzzle. And that was that when they're doing the experiments, I understand they capture the living dead guy using the acrylic mechanism. And by the way, I like the idea of throwing the rope into the water first, I mean into the acrylic pit first, but what are the odds that that would actually trap the body the right way? You know, I think it should have been a net or something. Because I see the guy falls in the pit, you pull out the rope, and nothing happens. You've got a rope. But anyway, so they're running these tests to try to figure out how to defeat the aliens, and they're like, running tests. Then they say, we've tried everything, and nothing works. And then the alarm goes off, because the moron sets off the alarm, and then that hurts the alien. And then they go, oh, sound appears to be the equation. You didn't test sound? You said you tried everything. What the hell just happened? 5 minutes ago, you said, we tried everything, and I think I know what everything means, and nothing works.
Sound would have been a basic part of the equation.
You didn't test sound, and you're doofuses.
Yeah, speaking of doofuses, the scientist who has the mental breakdown.
Uh-huh, the wuss.
Why was he particularly having this mental breakdown? Nothing precipitated him going nuts. It's like, it really just came out of left field. Yeah.
Well, I think the idea was that they had established his character as, like, the weak link in the chain. And there was a thing where, you know, especially, you know what, I think he might have been okay as, like, a regular person in regular life. But he's one of those people who, when things get too stressful, is more likely to snap. And he kept going, well, we don't have to go outside, do we? And it's dangerous out there. And you don't think we should have to go outside, do you? And when even the woman is snapping at him and going, John, shut up! Then you're like, uh-oh. And look, any man is going to pale in comparison to John Agar.
John Agar, Mr. Shirley Temple in all his John Agariness.
Well, I mean, look, John Agar walks into the room and every other man's testosterone drops 50 points. No? Isn't that how that works?
Well, he did perform a lot with John Wayne, so he was in a lot of John Wayne movies.
He did. All right, Hawk, I'm now going to switch the order of my questions, because you've jumped ahead. Hawk, what are your feelings towards John Agar?
I have seen hunks of wood that are more emotive than John Agar.
Aww.
But the thing is, he's not very emotive. He's not. Yet for some reason, when I see him in a movie, I love him. I'm attracted to his not-emotiveness.
Yay.
There's a strange charisma in the fact that he has no charisma.
A wooden charisma?
it's really weird. And he delivers all his lines with the same inflection.
Uh-huh.
So, if it's sad, it's the same inflection. If he's in love, it's the same inflection. I mean, there's a romance plot between him and a female lead, and I didn't know. I mean, I kind of figured it out from what they were saying, and at least she seemed like she was emotionally invested, but when he was talking, it was basically, you know, kind of, I am interested in you. I like you. You, those 1950s torpedo bras are rather attractive.
Wasn't it the euphemisms? Didn't he say something like, I thought the two of you were engaging in research, or something along those lines? Do you have that written down?
He said one of my favorite lines that I had to stop the movie to write down, where he's talking to him. She said that she was at some point, she said, well, when I majored in psychology, I learned da-da-da-da-da. And then he was talking about Lamont, the other scientist who's a wuss, and he says, about Lamont, are you two majoring in each other? So I had to write that down.
Yeah, but he says that, are you two majoring in each other? There is no inflection whatsoever. I would, you know, the idea is he's supposed to be actually gauging her interest, and it's more as if he's giving her a medical exam. Do you feel any pain when I touch you here?
It's all in his eyebrows. He has those wonderfully arched eyebrows, and he does it all by not moving his eyebrows.
He barely moves his face.
Maybe we're reading this movie all wrong. Maybe John Agar is the alien.
No, the aliens are much too active, as we've seen. Once they expose them to this horrible sound waves, they're moving and bopping all over the place. And no, good guess, though. In a better world, that would be the solution. In a really good M. Night Shyamalan movie, that would be the twist ending.
Ouch.
You said good M. Night Shyamalan movie. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I think I prefaced that with alternate universe, didn't I? In another world, in a better world.
There are some, or there were some.
There was one.
And honestly, though, I mean, if you have not seen a John Agar film before, you know, the thing with John Agar that's pretty incredible is that, so from what I was reading, because I knew that he had this, you know, big film career, but the fact that he was married to Shirley Temple was what kicked off his film career. And he used to be in, like, good movies and big movies with John Wayne, as a matter of fact. Now, why would John Wayne put somebody who sounds like John Wayne in a movie with him? That's my question.
I have nothing. I mean, and he really doesn't sound like John Wayne. I can only say he sounds like John Wayne if John Wayne didn't have any charm.
Aww.
It made John Wayne look like John Gielgud to have John Agar acting next to him.
There you go. Okay. Well, look, you can find other, you know, John Agar stuff out there. I, in particular, I'm a big fan of The Brain from Planet Aarhus. So there is a bunch of good stuff. Just go on IMDb, type in John Agar, and then be prepared to scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll, because he was in a lot of stuff. But anyway, so Kevin, we touched on this a little bit earlier, but should we even bother trying to fact check this movie?
Science! Well, apparently the aliens destroyed all life on the moon 20,000 years ago when they first invaded. What life? Even life that was invisible didn't exist on the moon ever. There's no atmosphere, there's no nothing. Of course, we already touched on the fact that John Carradine was completely exploded in an atomic blast and then was reconstituted.
And he looks fine. I mean, a little gray, but he looks fine.
Can I interject something here?
Yes.
Yes.
There only seems to be a handful of women in this world, yet lots of men, which isn't literally possible. I mean, you need women to kind of make men. But that's not science. That's social. But
to be fair, there were more women than I expected to see at a hockey game. When they cut to the dozen people sitting in the bleachers at the hockey game, like, four of them were women. And I'm like, why are there four women at a hockey game?
And if you count the female lead, that might be all of the women in the movie.
Wait, Did we see her, the female sort of secretary at the Pentagon?
Yes,
we heard
she
her voice.
The phone.
Yeah, she answers the phone.
And she says things to the major that, unless the major had stuffing in his ears, he should have heard. To the not the major, but to the, you know, the general, the army guy. Hi, it's so and so, and they're having this problem. Yeah, he just said that, and I'm right here, and I heard that. You're leaving out a major, major, major thing, which is when the first, you know, animated guy, played by John Carradine, back from the dead, says, "Your scientists think that the moon is a dead planet."
No, they don't.
Yes.
They don't even think it's a planet.
I question the whole moon-planet thing. Like, do you not understand what a planet is?
I'd still like to see the Mythbusters guys fill up a giant spray can with acrylic and see if they could totally coat something with it.
They'd try. And
well,
poor Buster would feel the wrath.
Aw, ideally they could. Well, don't forget, there is something to be said for closing off the pores. Because didn't something horrible happen to the woman who was used in, the James Bond
Goldfinger.
Movie, Goldfinger?
Yeah.
Right, the one who had to have her body painted with gold and closing off your pores. And poor, what is his name, Buddy Ebsen, the first Tin Man,
mm-hmm.
right, with that silver spray?
That's right.
Well, he was having an allergic reaction to that stuff.
Oh, okay.
He had a very powerful allergic reaction to it, and they couldn't do anything about it. They didn't have any other makeup to use, so they had to recast. So
Buddy Ebsen, just to clarify, he wasn't a possessed alien possessing a dead guy, right?
No, although Buddy Ebsen has always looked old.
Okay, I did just want to clarify that. All right.
Sort of like Wilford Brimley.
Yeah, there's somewhere he looked less ancient.
We do know that sound waves can crack things, though, as we saw in the film, from that Memorex commercial with Ella Fitzgerald, was it? Where she sings that high E over C and...
Mm-hmm.
And yes, sound waves can crack things. But apparently, more than anything else, they force aliens wrapped in bandages to become visible and leave human zombified bodies.
You know, to be fair, I don't know if it was wrapped in bandages. I think that it was a guy in an alien suit from another movie, It, Terror from Beyond Space. And the fact that it was all white and blurry made it look like it was wrapped in bandages. I mean, you couldn't really see it that clearly, but I think that they recycled an alien suit from another movie.
Okay, well, to me, it looked like Boris Karloff in The Mummy.
Oh, dear. But to be fair, there was a lot of stuff recycled from other movies or from other sources. I mean, in addition to all the stock footage, there's the car crash that was recycled from another movie. There was the plane crash that was recycled from an Air Force test experiment. Because you're like, well, look at this plane and how it crashed. Yeah, it crashed into that big X on the side of the mountain because it was a test plane that was supposed to crash into the side of the mountain. Oops. I just liked a lot of the scientific, you know, mumbo-jumbo when, half of my notes are things that were said at the beginning of the movie by, you know, the possessed John Carradine, talking as the alien. And so half my notes are in all caps, where I would say, "Long ago, we learned to change the molecular structure of our bodies." And I was like, okay, any minute now he's going to start with, "We are to you as you are to the amoeba," you know.
It's the science in this movie reminds me of one of my favorite lines in any B-movie.
Yes?
A scientific line in a B-movie. And you're familiar with this one from The Amazing Colossal Man.
Woo! Ah, yes, 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 yes.
We know the heart is a single cell.
And what?
The heart is a single what now? That is the science in this movie.
Yeah, and I mean, I do think that another, you know, I mean, the big part of the science is. Why do aliens who are invisible become visible to fight. If you just stayed invisible, you could just stay invisible and you would win, and it would be over in 5 minutes. But then again, we wouldn't even have a movie. So there's that.
Welcome to Invisible Invaders and the beginning of the and we're defeated. Bye.
It would be a short rather than a full-length movie.
Also, they want us to surrender in order to avoid war, in which case they'll then just still take us over anyway. So.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, surrender and you'll stay alive. For what?
So we can kill you and take you over, though we don't know why.
Right. Okay, so Hawk, we've touched on this a little bit already, but one of my favorite aspects of this film was the very serious narration and dialogue. And I know that you have seen a lot of the old B-movies like I have. So why is listening to dialogue and narration like that, why is listening to that kind of stuff so much fun? And do you have any favorite lines from this movie?
I don't really have any favorite lines from this movie. But I have to tell you, one of the reasons it's so much fun is talking in exposition is just hearing exposition being spoken. There's just something about it. Because that form of storytelling is long gone. And in many respects, it's a holdover from the age of radio. If you're listening to any old radio programs, especially things where the action is very descriptive. I'll give you an example. There's a lot of narration or a lot of characters talking about what they're doing in The Adventures of Superman. Superman describes everything he's doing when he's doing it. And there's just something about it. It's like, wow, you know, I'm in on it. Now, when it's visual, it's not as much necessary, but it's really a holdover to that kind of feeling of radio. I get that same kind of feeling I get when I watch old-time radio, which I don't watch old-time radio. When I listen to old-time radio, I get a lot of that same feeling when people speak in exposition. So maybe that's just the incredible geeky old-time radio fan in me, but I mean, I get that kind of same kind of juice when I hear it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that some of the expositional stuff, right, is like that, is sort of assuming that you can't see what's going on, so you have to describe what's going on. But then when you can see what's going on, you're kind of going, why are they describing what's going on? Because we know what's going on. I do love the fact that, you know, Superman's up, up, and away was originally from the radio because you wouldn't know that he was flying. So that's how he told the audience, I am now going up and flying. And then Hawk, what would he say when he was landing?
Down, down.
So they left that part out when it, you know, changed TV and movies and stuff. But then he would still say up, up, and away. I mean, they, you know, would hold on to part of it. I noticed that it got a little talky like that when there was the fight towards the end when the Wuss Doctor is fighting against John Agar. And she's like telling the scientist and the daughter are standing there, and she's telling him, oh, stop it. Oh, look, now he's doing this. Look, now he's doing this. Yeah, I see it. I'm right here. I see what he's doing.
John Agar is supposed to be this highly trained military man, and then there's this wussy scientist. Why doesn't Agar take him down with one punch? There's an actual fight.
Yeah, what's up with that? Maybe he didn't take his vitamins that morning.
You know, really, the scientist should wind up, hit John Agar in his wooden face, break his hand, and then Agar should kick him in the nether regions. Oh, wait a minute. He doesn't have any testicular fortitude because he doesn't have any testicles.
Ah.
And then the fight should be over. But, yeah.
But what I also thought, because when, like, I was first watching, and this was still within the first couple of minutes, I love expositional dialogue, and especially when it's clunky, I find it very funny. So one of the first lines that I wrote down was like the you know, the military guy and the scientist, and the narrator is like, they show this stock footage of the Pentagon, right? And then the narrator tells us that these people are going to be having this conversation, very important people. So the military, so you see two guys, one guy's wearing a suit, one guy's dressed up in a military outfit. The military guy says, Dr. Penner, science is your business. protecting this country is mine. And I went, mwahaha! And I wrote that down. But keep in mind, that's another way to really keep the film tight in terms of running time. Like, you don't have to introduce those characters. You don't need any backstory. He just goes, here's the exposition. This is this, and this is this, and I am you, and you are me, and, you know. And here we are.
I do have to say that line you just mentioned, it's one of the better lines in the movie.
Aw. Well, I mean, I also loved a lot of the the undead John Carradine, a lot of his lines I loved, you know, were along with your scientists think that the moon is a dead planet. That was another one of my top favorites. But, you know, and also when he's talking about, you know, my people will come to your planet and inhabit the bodies of other Earthmen. The dead will kill the living. Like, yay!
But it's said with John Carradine's voice.
Yeah, I mean, he could sell you anything. That's why I love him. I love him. I love John Agar. They talk so seriously. So they could say the most ridiculous stuff, but it sounds like they believe it.
I'll have a taco. Okay, you'll have a taco. I believe you're having a taco. Good.
Kevin, do you have any favorite lines from the movie or thoughts on the super serious narration and dialogue?
The cheesier the movie, the more serious the narration you need. Because that way you can trick the audience into think they're actually seeing things they aren't seeing. Like quality. Think about it. Narration in films is really a dead art. Maybe we should bring it back. It was in The Muppets at the very beginning. It's like, hi, that's me, I'm Walter. There's my brother Gary. I know what you're thinking. We could be twins. Other than that, when was the last time you had really good narration in a quality Hollywood film?
Yes,
when did Blade Runner come out?
From Blade Runner to The Muppets. There's a doctoral thesis in that.
Blade Runner, the narration that's been removed from every other cut since.
But see, the thing is, I like it if it's a tradition. But see, Blade Runner narration is in the tradition of that noir, film noir narration, where it's also like, you know, like, this is me. You know, this is me, and this is how I was, and she walked into my office, and her legs went all the way up, or whatever. You know, you're kind of getting a sense of the character. But get a kick out of narration that's like, and now this is what's happening in our story. You know, so they would keep saying, you know, the first warning came in the form of a major air crash in Syracuse, New York. The pilot had been killed. You know, it's like a newsreader, you know, telling you something.
Do you think it has an actual historical resonance for people in the 50s? And this is probably going really way out, by saying, oh, this is the sort of stuff we've seen in newsreels. This makes it easier for me to relate to what I'm seeing. Like an attempt at verisimilitude, like suddenly seeing a news host from CNN in a movie interviewing Matt Damon, who's playing a senator or something like that.
I wouldn't be, honestly. That's probably a large part of it. Also because still in 1959, before the advent, you know, before the popularity of television, before television was really, you know, I mean, 59 was the beginning, it was part of the beginning of, you know, television being a thing everywhere. But television still in its infancy, a lot of news was still delivered, you know, through the movies and through radio. So it's a transitory time in filmmaking, and some of the old stuff still carried through. I liken it in some ways. I watched a lot of cartoons. I still watch a lot of cartoons. I love animation as an art form. And in the 60s and the 70s, almost everything had either a narrator or a character speaking in exposition. And one of the things that happened as you got to the 80s was there was this period in the 80s where things started flowing a little differently. Storytelling started evolving. And that's a change because storytelling was evolving elsewhere. And sometimes it takes a little time for mediums to catch up and realize that, hey, we don't have to do it the way it was done before. That time is either passed the people who are writing in that medium by, or they feel a need to connect the audience to a previous medium. So I think there's a lot of that going on.
Well, it's definitely honoring the tradition of, like, this is the way that you're used to hearing your news. I read a review in one of the reviews that I read that said they were sort of forming it like a documentary. And I guess that was sort of, you know, the part of it. Like, this is how you would hear the serious things. But a lot of these 1950s black and white movies would, you know, have a narrator who talked like that, you know, who talked to you like a very serious newsreader. But the thing is, that's why I find it more hilarious to find somebody like that telling you about something that's so ridiculous. And even with big stupid monsters or zombies chasing people around, if you have the guy saying, you know, and then the first warning came this way. The invader, using the pilot's body, had come to issue the first public threat to the people of Earth. And by the way, remember how the dead pilot says, people of Earth, this is your last warning?
Where was the first one?
Well, this is the thing. He says, this is your last warning. And then they cut to another thing where another guy is making an announcement, and that guy says, this is your last warning. Like, do you not understand what a last warning is? You mean that was my second to last warning?
Okay, now this guy's totally, we totally mean it this time. This is your last warning. Dude, totally.
To be fair, the first warning was when, you know, Dr. Penner tried to tell the public what was going on. And that was so badly received that the newspapers were openly mocking him.
That was a really good joke. The blank page. First photo of invisible invader. That was a great joke.
That was cute.
They don't believe the respected scientist. But they believe someone who comes in off the street and announces it in a hockey game.
Hi, I was just at a hockey game, and somebody made an announcement over the loudspeaker from the booth, so clearly we're being invaded by aliens.
But the respected scientist, nah.
Well, and that was the other thing, too. Now, I understand why they did the whole newspaper headline thing, but let's sort of analyze what happened. So Dr. Penner goes to meet with the higher-ups in Washington, D.C., to have a discussion with the, you know, the higher-ups, the heads of the government, to tell them about this warning. And then, immediately, you see the headline from the Daily Capital, charges of space attack branded ridiculous. Okay. So, this wasn't a secret meeting? And the government people blabbed to the press immediately? They said, hey, guess what? Press corps, you're always hanging around the White House. Let me tell you what just happened. Some nut job walked in off the street and says there's an alien invasion. And then they tell all the newspapers that. That seems a little harsh. But by the way, I was looking at the newspapers because I was hoping for, you know, when you see enough of these movies, you see where they use the same headlines over and over again. So you look for the big headline that they put in with the character's face and whatever, and then there'll be a smaller headline next to it that says, like, new petitions against tax or building code under fire. They're like the same two or three that keep coming up. And so I was looking for those, and I didn't see them in this movie, but I did see something that was weird because I was looking, and one of them had a little side headline, and now I have to find it, about gold and silver being found in the ocean. I don't know where that came from. I don't know if that was an actual headline or if the people who were putting the movie together said, hey, let's just throw in this wacky headline off on the side about gold and silver being found in the ocean. It never goes anywhere. Oh, yeah, it actually says, ocean at last yields its gold and its silver.
Whew. I've been waiting for that.
I know. I was like, it is?
I can go panning down at the beach now.
Well, I'd be a metal detector now.
Let's go out to a diving platform and start looking for that. Okay. So, let's see. We did some fact-checking. We did this. We talked about John Agar. Okay, now I want a minute to talk about the parallels between this film and Plan 9 from Outer Space, which, by the way, came out, like, right at the same time. And the more I watched this film, the more parallels I saw. Am I crazy, or do I have something here?
No, no. Starting with the very first point, which is, we're going to reanimate the dead in order to do... exactly what? You know, in Plan 9, it was basically, you weren't giving us enough respect. We're going to reanimate your dead, and then you'll pay attention to us. And then this one's like, we're going to reanimate your dead in order to take over the world, which you don't really need to do, because we're already here, and we're invisible.
You have a lead actor in both of these films that's an established horror star, John Carradine in Invisible Invaders, and Bela Lugosi in Plan 9 from Outer Space, although Lugosi, of course, died during filming.
But on screen, they both die very suddenly and, like, off-screen death.
There's also a lot of narration in both of these films.
Yes, and that's another one with great serious narration. And then the aliens did this.
Cheap sets to begin with.
Of course, one that no one's going to mention, but torpedo bras.
Well...
that's merely a hallmark of the time. That's an indication of the culture. O tempore, o more.
There was a lot of that going around at this time. But even some of the, like when after the first scientist dies and everyone is standing there at the funeral, that looked like Plan 9 from Outer Space. You know, where they're all standing there around, you know, this very cheap set that's supposed to look like a graveyard, but it's not.
Shuffling dead as opposed to walking dead.
Yes, there's that, right? Why can't the aliens pick up their feet, exactly?
The incredibly slow-moving aliens.
Yes, and let's think. There was something... oh, you know what else sort of reminded me? There was a room that they used, I think, twice in this movie. Remember the room that they used, and they're like, oh, this is the announcing booth at the hockey arena, but it just looked like a room?
Mm-hmm.
I am 90% sure that that's the same room that they use at the end of the movie when they're in a separate room at the UN.
That
it's like,
be.
Here's a room that we're just going to use for this. That reminded me of, yes, we are in the cockpit of an airplane.
That was let's great because it had drapes behind it.
Let's just hang up a shower curtain behind us and, yes, this is the cockpit of an airplane. And also, don't forget, similar principle, similar reason for why the aliens are attacking. Your scientific development has gotten too far. So now we're going to kill you. Right? You have advanced too much technologically. Yep. So would you guys rate this as a good, bad movie or a bad, bad movie? And why?
I'm going to go bad, bad movie.
Oh.
A lot of it has to do with the fact that this was done... I've seen a lot of bad movies.
You have.
I mentioned before The Amazing Colossal Man. However, The Amazing Colossal Man had a budget and didn't just use stock footage, and the actual effect was visible on screen. You saw the giant man. You saw The Amazing Colossal Man. Invisible Invaders... it's a bad, bad movie because it's a cheat. You know, I don't know whether or not the studio just had a few extra bucks left over that they had to spend. Maybe the executive producer broke his kid's piggy bank.
Aw.
And he's like, ooh, there's some cash here. What can I do with it? I can buy my kid ice cream, or I could make a really cheap movie. I'm going to make a really cheap movie. And that's the problem. It feels like you could have either made this movie or bought a scoop of Rocky Road.
Kevin, what do you think? Good, bad? Bad, bad.
Bad, bad.
Aww.
First of all, there's no musical numbers in this movie. That's a
oh, come on!
That's a great way to save a bad movie. When in doubt, throw in some musical numbers.
And that would have cost money. And they didn't have stock footage of a musical number.
Considering it's got okay actors and bad actors and relatively good actors, I don't feel like any of them were really used effectively. It's one thing to have dialogue that's so clever or dialogue that's so stupid it's amusing. This one, the dialogue just sort of sat there, and even the dialogue didn't really move along the plot. They relied on the narrator for that, no matter how classical an institution that may be. And it just felt slow. You know, something like Plan 9 is a longer movie than this, but moves along at a great clip. A lot of interesting things happen. Here, a whole lot happens, but it's not very interesting, and the whole thing just drags and drags and drags. A good bad movie is one where when it's over, you say, hey, okay, great. When this one is over with, I just said, oh, thank God, that was never going to end.
Aw. Well, for what it's worth, I vote that this is a good bad movie. Even though John Carradine was not on screen enough, even though we have to wait 25 minutes for John Agar to appear in this picture, I just got a kick out of the pacing and the sort of doofy situation and how everybody seemed to take that doofy situation so seriously. So I got a kick out of it. So you can write in and comment and say whether or not you agree with, you know, the right answer or the wrong answer.
Andrea's answer is the wrong answer.
Hey, I don't care if I'm outvoted here. I think that I will be, I was going to say exonerated.
You're going to be vindicated by the vote?
That's what I think.
The court of public opinion.
Vindicate me. Okay. So, guys, unfortunately, our time together is drawing to a close. Aww. So let's discuss what we learned from Invisible Invaders. And if you have more than one thing, let's do one at a time. Okay, so Kevin, you first. What did you learn from this movie?
Just one thing, but it's important. For a quality Geiger counter, rely on the Tektron brand, made with pride in North Hollywood, California.
Woohoo! Okay, Hawk, what did you learn?
If you can make your movie on a budget where you have a choice between making the movie and a scoop of Rocky Road ice cream, you should take the ice cream.
Aww. All right, and the first thing I learned from this movie is that the moon is actually a planet. Okay, Hawk, you have any more? Give me your next
one. I'm done.
Oh, man, I got a whole list. All right, now see, this is why I think it's a good bad movie, because I learned a lot of things from this movie.
It's educational.
Okay. Here is what I learned from this movie, all right? Strap yourselves in. Atomic labs are filled with beakers of different fluids. Okay. John Agar looks fetching in a flight suit. I learned that. Okay. Is the hot chick giving you the cold shoulder? Offering her a cigarette will help break the ice.
Oh, yes. Smoking
That's
in a sealed
awesome.
Environment.
Yes. Want to tell the hot guy who sounds a little like John Wayne that you're reconsidering that whole not if you were the last man on earth attitude? Offer to make him some coffee. Okay. Smoking cigarettes a few feet away from a controlled scientific experiment is always a good idea. Okay. A radiation suit does not, repeat not, need to be airtight.
Oh, good point. It looked like it was made of terry cloth.
Well, the damn thing just draped over his head, and every time he leaned forward, it could be leaning in enough stuff to kill him in 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's like a beekeeper's mask.
Exactly. Well, I'm sure that's what they could afford. No matter what kind of scientific experiments you do in any kind of lab, you never, ever, ever need to wear gloves or goggles. Okay? And amazing scientific equipment can be built using nothing more than wrenches, screwdrivers, and pliers.
Well, MacGyver proved that a long time ago.
Well, I think he'd use a rubber band and a paper clip or something.
But he always had a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah.
There's that. See? That'll help. Okay, so now we are going to do our other tradition, which is the drinking game. So remember that the idea of the drinking game is that as you're watching this movie, you should take a drink every time blank happens. So, Kevin, let us hear your first rule of the Invisible Invaders drinking game.
Yep. take a drink every time stock footage is used.
Oh, God. Hawk?
Take a drink every time you hear stentorian tones of narration.
Let me cross that one off. Okay. Take a drink every time you hear a ticking Geiger counter. Kevin?
Take a drink every time somebody's full name is used. So, Carol Penner, you must deliver this message. Carol Penner, you must deliver this message to the people of Earth, etc., etc.
Hawk?
Take a drink every time John Agar emotes. Oh, wait. Sorry. You'd be stone cold sober at the end of the movie.
Aw. Take a drink every time you hear a theremin. Okay,
I
Kevin?
Always do. Take a drink every time the narrator is describing something that you are seeing with your own two eyes.
Hawk?
Take a drink every time you see a cheap, invisible special effect.
Take a drink every time you see the zombie invaders walking down that same hill again.
Take a drink every time somebody shuffles.
Oh, God. Hawk?
Take a drink every time someone enters or leaves the bunker.
Ooh. Ah. The airtight, nuclear-proof bunker, yes.
Yeah, you think. Take a drink every time you hear John Carradine's voice, even after his body is dead and presumably reburied. Kevin?
I'm out.
Okay, Hawk?
Take a drink every time our female lead does something so very 50s housewife-ish. Let me offer to make you coffee.
Yay! Mm-hmm.
She does that a lot.
And my last one is take a drink every time someone asks a stupid question or says something that's blindingly obvious. Okay, Hawk, you have any more?
I am out.
All right. So, we are good. We have learned from the movie, some of us more than others. We have established the rules of the Invisible Invaders drinking game. We are not responsible for you losing consciousness during the duration of the movie if you actually decide to follow the rules of the drinking game.
Well, unfortunately, one of my rules actually prevents that.
Yes, that's true. The poor person is going to be sitting there waiting to take a drink. Jesus, isn't he going to emote at some point? I'm getting a little thirsty here. All right, so that is it for our discussion of Invisible Invaders. And now, let's start planning ahead for our next episode. Kevin, tell us about the movie that you picked for us to watch next month.
Well, next month is going to be a bit of a departure. We're going to cover a musical, the greatest musical of all time. Yes, the one starring Gene Kelly, Xanadu, from 1980. Okay, actually starring Olivia Newton-John. You may know her best as Sandy from Grease, but here she plays one of the nine Olympian muses. She is Terpsichore, the muse of dance. And she's here to inspire a record album cover painter, played by Michael Beck, today best known as an audiobook narrator, to open a nightclub, the titular Xanadu. Gene Kelly makes his final film appearance, excluding documentaries, as our hero's business partner, who was himself once inspired by Terpsichore. Music by ELO, roller disco, set at the Pan Pacific Auditorium, one of my favorite streamlined modern buildings from the 1930s, what's not to love?
Can I just...
Poor Gene Kelly. I love Gene Kelly.
I have to interject something here, and I apologize for the interruption. But why is it all these great actors, their last role is kind of awful? Gene Kelly, Xanadu, Orson Welles, Transformers, the movie.
Oh.
And Raul Julia, Street Fighter, the movie.
Oh.
Don't they all deserve better?
Yes. Yes. So thank you, everyone, for listening. And if you'd like to follow me online, please check out BeABetterBookTalker.com. It's a blog, it's a podcast, and you will find out about more books than you can shake a stick at. Plus, I occasionally appear with Dan Persons on the Cinefantastique podcast to discuss movies if they are based on books. And you can find that podcast on CinefantastiqueOnline.com. So, Kevin, where can people find you online?
You can find me on LiveJournal at kevinlauderdale.livejournal.com and on the Chronic Rift Network, where I do another monthly podcast called It Has Come to My Attention, where I just talk about pop culture and genre items that have simply come to my attention.
Okay, and Hawk, where can Temple of Bad fans find out more about you?
And you guys can find out more about me at multimediumrare.com, which is my pop culture and perspective blog.
Fantastic. And before we go, I would like to plug two more websites. So everybody within the sound of my voice, make sure that you all visit mightymoviepodcast.com and our new domain, templeofbad.com.
Woohoo!
Woo! So that will be all for this episode of Mighty Movies Temple of Bad. Kevin Lauderdale, thank you for joining us.
Yay! Glad to be here.
Arenthal Hawkins, thank you for pitching in and being our special guest.
I'm special? That's awesome. And thank you for having me.
Dan Persons, hiatus be damned. We want you back on the show, you hear? And I am Andrea Lipinski. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And until next time, may a bad film be the worst thing to happen to you.